Back at it, busy show to kick off a new week. Monday, March 15th on Connecticut Today. We talked about the production, perhaps, in the future of legal marijuana in the state. Who's going to grow all that weed that people may or may not smoke or eat? Reno Ferraresi joined us from CT Pharma to talk about that. Governor Ned Lamont's coronavirus briefing, first of two for the week, centered on looser restrictions and a speed up in the process for getting a vaccine in Connecticut. And Fairfield County Republican State Rep Laura Devlin joined us in the 5 o'clock hour talking about several bills in both taxation and regarding local control of zoning that are squarely targeted from Democrats toward Fairfield County. Marijuana, because why not? It's always a good time to talk marijuana, and we still don't have any further movement. I did a little checking over the weekend. Still no further movement on a bill that would legalize recreational marijuana. Now, what would that portend for the future? I'm going to talk to a gentleman who is involved in the business of growing medical marijuana in the state, and would his business segue over to that? And what does he see as the recreational for adults only marijuana market? How big would that be? Bigger than people think? Smaller? Who knows? We welcome back a gentleman we've had on before. Reno Ferraresi is the president, COO, and founder of CT Pharma, biotech company with clinical stage and discovery assets derived from cannabis. They have a facility up in the north of Hartford area and have also worked with Yale University in the past. Reno, it's Paul here again, my friend. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Good afternoon. Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you back, and I'm glad that your folks contacted me because, boy, since last time we've talked, Reno, nothing is in finality here, but there is some movement. First of all, before we start talking about your projections on recreational pot, I think since the last time we talked, Reno, state officials have okayed even more conditions that are eligible for the use of medical marijuana in this state, which I think something like 50,000 people are eligible for now. So for CT Pharma's core business, that's good for you guys.
It is. The real boost came last summer when the program permitted the use of or the chronic pain condition as the qualifying condition for medical marijuana participation.
And what has your research, and I know you work with scientists all the time and the people that help you cultivate the product here in Connecticut, what are the found benefits, Reno, of marijuana for use with people that have conditions like chronic pain who may not want to use painkillers or may have not had luck with them?
Some people find relief, and in our program here in Connecticut, it's strictly for palliative use. So we're not curing or mitigating disease. It's really just strictly on a palliative basis, and that's what the products are for.
All right, Reno, hang out. I want to talk with you a little more about what you see in the future here going forward. Reno Ferraresi is the guest, president and COO, and the co-founder of CT Pharma. Back with Reno. More from him straight ahead. First, traffic and weather together. 3:36 right here on WICC. And if and when the General Assembly ever gets around to approving it, yeah, folks in Norwalk, I would assume some folks there anyway may want to partake of adult recreational marijuana, perhaps. And a gentleman who knows all about that, Reno Ferraresi, is on the phone with us. He's currently the president and COO and co-founder of CT Pharma, the company who has a big facility here in the state that already supplies much of the medical marijuana use. But Reno, obviously you and your staff have been keeping, I would think, an eagle eye on, look, the potential market for this. I mean, somebody, Reno, has to grow the marijuana that may be sold by these retail outlets, if and when the General Assembly ever gets around to doing this. Do you foresee your company being involved here, Reno, in being essentially a grower to supply the market here in the state?
It's hard to say. At this point, we are one of four licensed medical marijuana producers that support 50,000 patients in the medical program today. Mm-hmm. It's hard to just be guessing at what the adult use population might look like. We've heard estimates of anywhere of a market to upwards of 500 million dollars a year potentially of of market. I mean, we see a $1 billion market in Massachusetts, and there are lots of businesses that are licensed to support that program up there. So it would probably be reasonable to think that Connecticut might look the same as a Massachusetts or New York or New Jersey, let's say. New Jersey is also an adult use state.
Yeah, they just they passed it not too long ago. I know Virginia just okayed it. So I guess by the info I have here, about 18,000 to 20,000 pounds of flower, Reno, was used in 2020, the estimate for medical marijuana. So I see you have an adult use here estimate of, sounds like a lot, 100,000 pounds of flower in 1 year. That's a lot. I mean, I can imagine having to, and we're talking usable flour, so it's actually far more than just 100,000 pounds of usable flour that would have to be grown, correct?
Oh, definitely north of 100,000 pounds, probably closer to about 150,000 plus. And then there are also lots of different other products and lotions and tinctures and edibles, and there's a lot of potential product offerings that we would see in an adult-use Connecticut market.
Mm-hmm. Reno, talk to me about the potency issue here. One of the issues that I always hear, and you obviously hear as well, is that the pot that maybe I smoked or our parents smoked or, you know, was smoked up until 10 or 15, 20 years ago, kind of the homegrown stuff, the THC level was not as potent as some of it is today. How is that controlled, Reno, in a controlled commercial large environment? Do you grow different grades, different strengths, and how is that done? That's fascinating to me.
So there is one grade, and it's all pharmaceutical grade here in Connecticut. It's put through very strict testing for purity and composition. But beyond that, understand that this is an industry, so we have specific plants that have been cultivated for the purpose to yield desired effects. The old stuff, you know, back in the 70s and the 80s might have been 4 or 5% THC by weight. Today we're seeing strains that are north of 30% THC by weight. It's much more potent today.
So is this kind of like, and this may be a bad analogy, Reno, but is this kind of like winemaking where wine folks know what grapes are going to yield what, and there's different, you know, processes for breeding plants and growing and moisture content? Is that what you folks do in the business too?
Exactly. There is. It's very standardized. Specific strains that have specific traits are selected for cultivation and for production, and then there are very regimented processes in place for consistency so that the flower, the end flower, always has the same moisture, has the same. It's standardized, really. It's a consumer packaged good in America today. It's like a Hershey bar, let's say. It's, you know what to expect as a consumer when you buy it. And that's what we expect in America today in 2021.
And obviously, if you were to engage in any sort of a contract agreement with Connecticut or any other state, it's incumbent upon you and the folks that work with you at your facility or facilities. That's a big responsibility, isn't it, to make sure that, just like any other product, you're churning out what folks are asking for and what they expect.
And that's true today. We're regulated as a dietary supplement in Connecticut. In addition to the strict security requirements that go along with being in a medical marijuana program, Connecticut has an added requirement that we meet with what are called current good manufacturing practices. And those are the same practices that the FDA requires biotech companies, cosmetic companies, food companies to meet so that the final products meet standards of purity, identity, et cetera, so that it's safe and appropriate for consumption.
I interviewed Reno, a scientist, some time ago, a couple of them actually, who said that we're still kind of on the cusp here, Reno, of learning the beneficial aspects of marijuana, and this person explained the different cannabinoids, I guess, that are in the cannabis plant, how I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, they mentioned there were like 60 or 70 of them, and we've kind of only scratched the surface, and, you know, we have some of these medical testing and medical trials going underway here.
There are. So there are many different cannabinoids. There are probably hundreds of different medicinally active compounds present in the flower, in the plant, and we are just scratching the surface of understanding the medicinal benefit. But there is ongoing research. Like you said earlier, CT Pharma is proud to be sponsoring a study at the Yale School of Medicine in a collaboration. We expect to publish results from our early study probably by the early April, mid-April. Mm-hmm. And then based on those study results, we would launch into a second phase study and really to understand sort of the medicinal effects of cannabis in treating certain pain and stress.
And I'm told here, Reno, you've got another study underway with UConn. Is that right?
Yes. We are proud to be partnered with Dr. Berkowitz's lab and supporting. We're working with a graduate student in developing industrially viable cannabis strains because, you know, today it's there's a lot of variation when you source strains from breeders. You're not always guaranteed that the strains that you source will be, you know, sort of industrially viable. And what we're doing is figuring out with Dr. Berkowitz different ways to develop disease-resistant strains that produce desired cannabinoid profiles, different terpene profiles. So that's what we're doing with Dr. Berkowitz.
Where does your business find folks to work for you? Do you look for farmers and botanists and people that have a general knowledge base and then build the cannabis base on that? That would fascinate me. Where do you get these folks?
Well, our cultivation department is overseen, is managed, directed by an agronomist. He's a doctor of agronomy.
Okay.
So he's an expert cultivator. But there are lots of different jobs, you know, packaging department, in our quality control, quality assurance departments. We're just like a regular biotech company, you know, like a typical pharmaceutical manufacturing company. At the end of the day, this is manufacturing.
And quality control. Sure. Reno, thank you. Reno Ferraresi, president and COO and the co-founder of CT Pharma Biotech Company, which provides the bulk of the medical marijuana being used here in the state by some 50,000 people. And who knows, down the road, they may add the adult recreational use aspect as well. Reno, thank you. Good to chat with you again, and let's stay in touch. Thanks.
Yes, thank you, Paul. Take care.
Thanks, Reno. Appreciate it. The company is CT Pharma, CTPHARMA. So you can check them out, ctpharma.com online. Reno Ferraresi. He is the president, COO, and co-founder of the company. And if you know anybody who is on medical marijuana, Reno's company is, they're the ones growing it. And they have a big facility, I think, up in Windsor Locks.
Changed. Remember, these are three-day numbers, so you can divide by three. Positivity rate, relatively stable, as are hospitalizations, sadly, and fatalities. I do look around. I see that it's spiked up just a little bit in New York. That's up to about 4.6%. Then sometimes you look around the world to get an idea of what else may be happening. You probably have seen Europe has gotten hit pretty hard. Poor old Italy is closing down again. A little different than our situation in that Italy only has about 3% of their people fully vaccinated, maybe 6% have their first shot. Very different than the United States, which is at about 21%. So they are in a different situation. Israel, on the other hand, has well over 50% of their people vaccinated and moving back very quickly to a normal, cautiously normal lifestyle, which is something that we can all hope for. Vaccinations are key, which takes us to the next slide. And you can see a fair amount has happened. We now have almost 60% of our folks 55 and above have received their first dose. 77% of the people 75 and above. A little interesting, you do get a law of diminishing returns. That's only up, I think, a percentage point since last time. 71% of the folks 65 to 74, that's up a few points, but slowing as well. 55 to 64, that's up from what, 32% just a few days ago. So that's still a pretty good activity there in that age group. And we think you'll see a significant uptick there, over 50% by the end of this week. Overall, about 31% of all of our adults 16 above, that's the only group, where we have vaccines that have been approved for people, have gotten their first dose, which is important. So because the rollout is going along pretty well, because the supply, we do have a three-week window from the Biden administration is strong and stronger than maybe we had anticipated even just a couple weeks ago, we're going to be able to accelerate our schedule just a bit. So what we had planned was to move into the group 45 to 54 on March 22nd. As you probably know, this Friday, March 19th, we're moving towards 100% occupancy in, retail and houses of worship and restaurants. So we think that March 19th is going to be the day we open up. So 45 to 54-year-old, there's about 130,000 appointments that are opening up right now this week. So, please step in and use this opportunity. I think perhaps of more import is that the group 35 to 44, which we're planning to open up on April 12th, is now going to open up a week earlier, April 5th. And frankly, we're going to open it up to everybody eligible, 16 and above, on that same date, April 5th. So that is a shift. There won't be any more grading by age after April 5th, which is about 3 weeks away. A couple of reasons for that. The 45 to 54-year-old age group is a smaller cohort, so we'll be able to get through that a little bit faster than we had anticipated before. And everybody in these age groups, maybe 20% of them have already been vaccinated. We vaccinated all of our healthcare workers, as you know. We've vaccinated, most of our educators, and the rest will be vaccinated, certainly by the end of this month. So that takes some of the load off. We've also seen that younger people may be a little less in a rush to get the vaccine. Don't take your foot off the accelerator. I want you to get vaccinated. We need everybody. But right now, there may be not quite the same demand as there were for, the 65-year-olds who are really, rushing the gate when their opportunity came up. And finally, it's worth noting our supply of vaccine is going up. We've got that three-week window. If we have 130,000-plus doses this week, it'll be about 40,000 more next week, and probably close to 200,000 the week of April 5th. So I think you can see that's a good 50% increase over the course of the next few weeks. That allows us to be a little bit more aggressive. And I want you to know one other thing, that there are, as of April 5th, there's no more change by age. Everybody is eligible, 16 and above. And that means our hospitals are going to be thinking very thoughtfully about folks that have, maybe some pre-existing conditions, IDD population. We're going to make a big effort to make sure that those folks who are, most at risk move to the front of the line. And I just want to say in general, as you see, we're opening up on March 19th and then April 5th. Again, there'll be a bit of a rush. So if you're relatively healthy, you maybe don't have to go to work every day, you can telecommute. If perhaps you think you've had some sort of a mild infection in the past, maybe don't, sign up that very first few days. Give those who maybe have a little more need up front a little earlier. We are going to have plenty of vaccines over the course of the next month. I think you're going to find everybody has vaccines and appointments available to them. Next chart will tell you a little bit about what our thinking is, why we're keeping with the 45 to 54-year-old age group. This was a University of California study. I think it's interesting. The age-based COVID vaccine rollouts could save 85% more lives. That was compared to just a random lottery system of everybody over 16. So I think it does make sense to at least prioritize the next age group for another 2 weeks. And finally, I think this chart understands what that last headline was about and what our thinking is about. We're going to have, say, two-thirds of the people 55 and above vaccinated over the next, 4 days. And that's where 96% of the fatalities have happened over the last year. And it's been a year. 96% in fatalities are sort of a proxy for hospitalizations and demand upon our healthcare system. You know, only 4% were related to folks 16 to 54. And then if you look at the next chart there, in purple you see the group of 45 to 54, which we're prioritizing for the next 2 weeks. While it's not nearly in the same category as the folks older, they're still 14 times more likely to suffer complications and fatalities than the youngest age group. So we thought it made sense to prioritize this smaller cohort, you know, at least for those 2 weeks. And then from there, 35 and below, everybody's going to be available, and we'll be able to make sure that those most in need are prioritized going forward. There'll be plenty of questions on that, and Josh and Paul can help answer. But first, I really wanted to introduce Sayla to you. As you know, this has taken an economic hit as well as a healthcare hit for a lot of our communities. We are blessed as a state to have a lot fewer folks rent arrears than most other states, but there's still a fair number of people who are unemployed, a fair number of people who haven't been able to get back to work, a fair number of people who have had a hard time making their rent payments and making their utility electric payments. And Sayla is taking the lead as we roll out a relief program funded by the federal government. Sayla?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Thank you, Governor. And yes, today is an exciting day for Connecticut. Unite City opened its door. It's a soft opening. Nevertheless, it's an opening. So Unite City stands for Emergency Rental Assistance for Connecticut's Economy. The goal of Unite City is to help stabilize Connecticut's rental housing market. This $235 million program will provide rental and utility payment assistance to qualified Connecticut households financially impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. The program will financially support households up to 80% of the head area median income. Eligible households, those who have qualified for unemployment or have experienced a reduction in household income, incurring significant cost, or experience a financial hardship due to COVID-19. Demonstrates a risk of experiencing homelessness or housing instability. Priorities will have those families with income up to 50% of AMI. The new program is featured with an online portal. Applicants can fill out a mobile device or computer, includes both tenant and landlord participation, and applicants can track progress and submission status. We have a call center, and it is the 1-844-UNITE-CT. If somebody needs help in completing the application is very easy. It takes 30 minutes. If you have a smartphone, you take a picture, and it will upload automatically. You can find the link to DOH, Unite City. Very easy to access the portal. So again, the number is 1-844-UNITE-CT or 1-844-864-8328. And I'm going to leave it at that if anybody has any questions.
Sayla, stick around for questions. It's worth noting that in this current tranche, we have capacity to work with 25,000 or so, either tenants or landlords, both of whom are eligible, to apply, one and the same. And we are going to be getting a second federal grant as part of the most recent tranche over the course of the next month or so. And that's 25,000. We've probably had 1,200 applications to date. So there's plenty of capacity, no need to rush. And Sayla and her team are ramping it up. But we'll also have a deal with United Way so we can get, mobile vans and in-person help as well. With that, Josh and Paul are here to help as well. Any questions?
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Yes, Governor. So it seems like we're going to have enough vaccine, but will our scheduling infrastructure be able to handle this demand? Because we're currently seeing, like, in this tier, there's still people struggling to get their appointments. So are there going to be any updates to the system between now and then?
Well, as you know, for the 55 and above, because we knew there was a lot of demand in that group, we greatly increased the number of people able to answer the phone. We increased the bandwidth for our website, and we've done extraordinary outreach. You know, I was in Bridgeport, I was in Stanford, going out to underserved communities, telephoning out, doing everything we can, bringing them there, filling out the forms for them. So if we need to do even more, you know, we'll do what it takes. But I do say, look, that first couple of days is always a crowd, and it takes a little bit of patience, and let those most in need get in the front of the line.
Exactly. And, you know, now that any adult will be able to schedule an appointment on April 5th, hopefully, what should the expectation be, though, for the date that we're going to actually be able to get vaccinated?
The expectation is on April 5th, you'll be able to make those appointments. Did I miss your question?
Yeah, so like we can schedule on April 5th, but what's the expectation for the actual date of the dose, like for the date of the appointment?
Oh, you'll be making appointments for that forthcoming week and then a couple of weeks thereafter. We'll see what the demand is. Our estimation is those younger age groups, the demand won't be quite as pent up as it was for folks my age, and that's one of the reasons we're expanding the aperture a little bit. And we are going to have 50% more doses as well, so we'll be able to satisfy a lot more first doses.
And my final one now, just any thoughts of a 24-hour vaccination clinic like we're seeing in New York, Yankee Stadium?
I think my sense is if we have the supply and the demand is there, we're going to do everything we can to get it out the door. Speed really matters here. You know, look at the difference between Italy and Israel, for example. So if it takes a 24-hour, we would do that. Right now, we're finding during the business hours we've got, we're able to do a pretty good job of matching supply and demand.
Thank you.
News 8.
So, Governor, by shifting the age groups around, what are the amount of people in each of the groups, like 16 to 45, 45 to 55, 55 to 65, including educators? So people have an idea of how many people are going to be going after the vaccine at one time.
Josh, that's too tough for me. You want to take it?
Sure. So in this next group, the 45 to 54-year-old age group, there's about 477,000 people in Connecticut of that age. However, we know that not everyone will rush out to get vaccinated. We've used a planning assumption, as we have throughout, of about 60%. So that's about 268,000 people we'd expect to be charging into this next phase. But it's also important to note about 85,000 of those people have already been vaccinated because they work in healthcare, they're phase 1A population, or perhaps are in the educator clinics that have been going really well. So we think there's about 200,000 people that are going to be in that age group looking to get vaccinated in the 2 weeks that we open who aren't already vaccinated. So that's about, you know, a week and a half to 2 weeks of supply at this point.
And then for the younger age group, you have 16 to 45. And,
sure.
Sorry to get into the details. Yeah.
No, that's okay. It's important. So from the 16 to 35, we've got about 1.3 million people in the state of that age. As the governor mentioned, we do expect, you know, the uptake there may be a little bit lower, but still sticking with that 60% planning assumption, that's about 785,000 people. And again, we've had, you know, about 160,000 people in those age groups already vaccinated. So that's maybe 625,000 to go, which, you know, as the governor said, with, you know, perhaps 200,000 doses a week in the month of April coming in, that gives us confidence that, you know, by the time we get to the end of April, early May, most everyone in Connecticut who's eager to get access and to be vaccinated should have that opportunity. And then the game will change to continuing to work to drive those rates up across the board in all of our communities.
And then just one last question for the governor. Does it seem like with the youth less likely to take the vaccine, how would you feel about colleges requiring it to get back into the dorms or schools to get back into the classroom? Should there be requirements there for the younger age groups?
Well, we've been talking to some of the colleges. They are thinking about providing the vaccine to everybody before they go home, either spring vacation or summer vacation, just so, and hopefully other colleges are doing the same thing, which would manage that. For schools, look, our strong recommendation is all the educators are going to be vaccinated. Right now, for the kids, none of the vaccines are approved for anybody 16 and under. So I think that's going to take a little bit longer.
NBC Connecticut.
And good afternoon, Governor Matt Austin with NBC Connecticut. I know during previous waves you had raised some concerns about kind of opening the floodgates because of some of the strong demand we had seen in other states and some of the challenges that they had run into. I guess how confident are you that we're not going to experience that with these upcoming dates and eligibility increases?
Well, look, I'm never super confident, but remember 6 weeks ago we had, you know, less than 50,000 doses. So we'll be up at 200,000 doses a week very soon. And we know exactly the cohorts, how big they are, and I think we do have a lot more capacity. You know, one estimation is there might be a little less urgency for the youngest folks, like I said, so that could tilt the balance a bit, but I think it's going to work out pretty well.
Yeah, I think it's worth pointing out that a lot of the issues we've seen in other states don't necessarily have to do with how many people become eligible all at once. It has to do with the very complicated and confusing eligibility criteria that have been rolled out that result in even more people than you anticipate charging into the line all at once, again, chasing that limited vaccine supply, which then crowds out, you know, the people who are most at risk. That's why governors pursued this age-based strategy, which has helped ensure that, you know, our most vulnerable elderly people have had a clean run at vaccine appointments for the last 2 months.
And just in terms of the vaccine sites that we have right now, can they handle the increased doses that the state is looking at, or are there plans to further increase vaccine sites, including, you know, mass vaccination clinics?
Keep going, Josh.
Yeah, our vaccine providers are ready to do far more. That for weeks they've been begging us for more vaccine. I commonly hear from people who go get vaccinated at some of these large mass vaccination sites. They say, it looks like they can be doing a lot more than they're doing. They've got a lot of extra chairs. And the answer is yes, they do. They're ready to go. And we have a very high degree of confidence that they'll be able to scale up as quickly as the supply comes from the federal government.
Okay, thank you.
Fox 61.
Thanks.
Fox 61.
What's your message to those individuals that fall between the 35 to 44 age group that are a little upset about this switch, feel like they've been cheated out of their specific chance with, let's say, less competition to make their vaccine appointment?
I haven't heard that, especially since we only announced it about 8 minutes ago. But I think people are going to understand that this is done based upon some good reasoning, that we got a lot more vaccine than we had even anticipated 3 weeks ago. I think people know we've been able to manage the flow pretty successfully for the last 2 months. I think people will be good.
I'd also just point out, up until this point, what we told those folks was that they were going to become eligible on April 12th, and the next phase would start in early May. And what we're telling them now is they're eligible a week earlier, and they're still going to get their vaccine before the end of April.
And then, are there any increased concerns about people from out of attempting to come to Connecticut to get a vaccine with this opening on April 5th?
No, you got to show, you know, license or ID that shows you live here in Connecticut. I think people are playing games in other states, a lot less likely to play games here.
Hope that this time maybe we can still do it, to go to Republican State Representative Laura Devlin to talk about what went on and what didn't go on here at, or rather in Hartford today, with some public hearings that went on via Zoom. We may or may not be able to bring Laura up. Mr. Producer, are we able to do that? Can you tell me if we can do that right now? All right. Should we give it a shot here? Laura, can you hear me?
I can hear you. How are you?
This is good, Laura. Thank you. So that means not all the equipment just blew up. Just kidding. Well, Laura, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it. And, you know, I have jokingly said earlier in the show, Laura, today was tax day. And I said, no, it's not April 15th. It's the Ides of March. It's March 15th, but I know you folks up there heard testimony today on what, Laura, more than one bill, I guess, that would look to impose nothing broad-based, but still some of these little nickel and dime or a mill here or a few hundred bucks here taxes by the majority Democrats. What happened today?
So, and Paul, it is still happening. We are only halfway through the number of people who have signed up to testify since 9 o'clock this morning. So there are several bills that are very troubling, and many have their eye on Fairfield County. And so these span from two that are focused on establishing a new statewide property tax that would assess a mill, which is $1 per $1,000 of assessed value, from dollar one on a commercial property and $300,000 of assessed value on a home. There is another bill that would assess property based on the amount of affordable housing that a particular town has. So these are just two of a couple of troubling bills in the Finance Committee.
Laura, I said earlier, and I'm glad you mentioned that at the outset. I said, folks, let's not beat around the bush here, because I never do. Look, there are some very nice upper income areas around Hartford, West Hartford, Farmington, Avon, Simsbury, West Simsbury. We all know that. East of New Haven, Guilford, Madison, Niantic areas there. But Laura, I think you hit it right on the head. These bills that are still being talked about today and the bill to Bigfoot local control of zoning and all the stuff you just talked about, squarely your district and other areas of Fairfield County are squarely in the crosshairs of some, at least, I don't know if it's the whole caucus, Laura, but some of the majority Democrats in Hartford.
Very much so, Paul. And in fact, two of the other bills that are being heard today, and largely the testimony on these two bills, have been in favor. They are progressive policies that would establish progressive tax policies to redistribute wealth in our state. It would impose a percentage property tax on higher income homes. It would increase the business tax rates. It would add a 5% tax on capital gains. It gives a one-time $500 payment for anybody who has received unemployment compensation. You know, it's pretty egregious at a time of coming out of the pandemic. Certainly a lot of people are hurting. Businesses are hurting. And this is an assault on the people, many of the people in our state.
You mentioned, Laura, a couple of seconds ago, something that tends to be an oh, by the way, when discussing this, what they call a mansion tax. Oh, by the way, this on the house, that on the house, $300,000 in the first exemption from the assessed value, but it counts all the way for businesses from the first dollar, correct? And if that's true, I wonder if that's being hidden and not being discussed, Laura, more precisely than it should be for a specific reason.
So the bill isn't fully fleshed out, and the language, unless you really read it carefully, you know, you're right, you kind of skip over that. And I don't know that that is well understood. But our state does not have a good track record with imposing taxes, right? Governor Malloy established the two largest tax increases in our state's history that were going to solve all of our problems. We had an increase in the sales tax just recently, justified to provide more money to our local towns. That never materialized. The lottery funds were supposed to support education. So establishing a new statewide tax on our homes when the governor campaigned on giving property tax relief is really outrageous.
And I'm wondering kind of out loud, Laura, here, when I see people saying, well, that mansion tax, look, we're going to give you a deduction of the first $300,000, and it's only on the assessed value. It's not on the retail value or the market value of what would be sold. So look, on this house, on a $400,000, $500,000 house, it's only $50, $100. You know, Laura, I don't believe in conspiracies, but is this just a way to get the thing on paper? And then does that tax rate, Laura, gradually inch up over the years, along with maybe the ceiling, the tripwire on this thing, you know, drop down to gradually make this more of a moneymaker?
Oh, absolutely, Paul. I mean, I can't even imagine a new tax being established in our state that isn't either expanded and or increased. So by all means, I would see that as being just based on the track record of the majority Democrat legislators that have held power in our state government for four decades.
So
that's been the mantra.
So what is your gut feeling on this, Laura, if you have one? I mean, look, the governor went on the record earlier today in Bridgeport. It's been at a couple of outlets where Governor Lamont has said, hey, I'm not for any tax increases. I don't think it's the time. He has upset the far left wing of his party. We all know that. Are these hearings today just to mollify people and satisfy people? Or might these bills actually make it out of committee and go to a floor vote?
So, you know, real good question. The two bills that we were referencing related specifically to the new statewide property tax. They were both introduced by Senator Looney in New Haven. He is the president of the Senate, so he certainly wields a lot of power. It could be a courtesy that his bills are being heard, but Republicans are far outnumbered in the legislature. So would I guarantee these wouldn't move forward? No, I wouldn't. But am I hopeful that they wouldn't? Yes, absolutely. The other two, which are these progressive, you know, new tax policies, probably are a, you know, backlash at the governor for, you know, holding firm on his path forward of saying he's not going to increase taxes.
Yeah.
But the progressive caucus is also quite sizable in the Democrat, among Democrat legislators. So, you know, hard to say that as well. I think what's really important is people let their voices be heard. Mm-hmm. They've got to pay attention to what's happening in Hartford, to our state government. They can watch the Finance Committee probably up till midnight tonight. And just as troubling is a hearing in Planning and Development of state control of local zoning. And that is another assault on Fairfield County. So it's really important that people get engaged and, you know, understand some of the things that are being pushed.
Laura, final question while I have you here. We had all this buzz and this momentum a couple of weeks ago for both the gambling legislation, which now I guess is on hold because of a difference with the Indian tribes, and there's still some disagreement about the legalization of recreational pot. Any changes on those? Is there a buzz in either caucus, or is it still radio silence?
You know, it has been relatively radio silence. So no news at this point on either of those.
All right. Laura Devlin, Republican State Rep, Fairfield. Laura, thank you. We appreciate the time and good luck. And good luck with having to sit through those hearings. We love you for it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Laura. Appreciate it. Laura Devlin, Republican State Rep, Fairfield. All right.